This episode sponsored by Vita Hustle.
Why aren't you eating right? Because eating right is hard? Because it isn't. Kevin Hart fixed it 4 damn years ago with The One. The One is Vita Hustle's game-changing meal-replacing super shake, inspired by Kevin Hart's passionate belief that we all have the right to eat right. Kevin Hart is referring to himself in the third person because he's fired up. Because The One just passed 5 million super shakes sold. 5 million. Just a quick gut healthy glass of The One gives you all the proteins, all the greens, and all the vitamins and more. One shake, no chaos. Listeners get 20% off their first purchase at VitaHustle.com. Go to VitaHustle.com. That's V-I-T-A, hustle.com.
November 1855. A provincial inn in the English Midlands. The fire has burned low. Gaslight flickers against walls stained yellow from years of tobacco smoke. In room 10 of the Talbot Arms, a man lies dying. John Parsons Cook is 28 years old. 3 days ago, he stood in a paddock at Shrewsbury, watching his horse cross the finish line first. He had £3,000 in winnings. Champagne in his glass, a future stretching out before him. Now his back arches off the mattress, his jaw locks, every muscle in his body seizes at once. The scream that tears from his throat wakes every guest in the building. And standing beside the bed, calm, attentive, taking his pulse, is his friend, his physician, the man who has been bringing him medicine all week. Dr. William Palmer does not call for help. He does not rush for remedies. He simply waits. It must have been a long wait. Palmer was patient. He had killed before. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. This is the story of the Rugeley Prisoner, a Victorian surgeon who turned his medical knowledge into a weapon. Some historians estimate William Palmer murdered 14 people. Others believe the true number was higher still. We know this with certainty. John Parsons Cook was his final victim. And Cook didn't die quietly. Over 3 episodes, we'll trace the path from Palmer's first suspicious death to his last breath on the gallows. We'll watch a friendship become a trap. We'll see Victorian science itself put on trial. Today, we meet our victim and watch him win the bet that sealed his fate.
To understand how John Parsons Cook died, we first need to understand how he lived. And the story begins with money he never had to earn. Cook's father died when John was young, leaving an inheritance of approximately £12,000 in 1855. That sum represented genuine wealth, enough to purchase a substantial country house, maintain servants, and live as a gentleman without ever working a single day. It was perhaps too much for a young man who had never learned discipline. Cook trained for the law. He attended lectures at one of the inns of court. He read case files. He observed proceedings. But he never practiced. He never took a client. Why suffer through the tedium of briefs and depositions when the money was already in his pocket? Instead, John Parsons Cook chose the racing circuit. The choice revealed something essential about Cook's character. In Victorian England, horse racing occupied peculiar social territory. The aristocracy bred the finest horses and placed the largest wagers, but the tracks themselves drew every class together. Gentlemen rubbed shoulders with bookmakers. Ladies watched from carriages while pickpockets worked the crowd. The thundering hooves and the moment when everything hung in the balance united them all. For Cook, racing became his entire existence. He purchased horses of his own, not one or two, but enough to constitute a genuine stable. He travelled the circuit religiously. Shrewsbury, Wolverhampton, Chester, Doncaster, Newmarket. He knew the form of every horse. He understood the ground conditions. He studied bloodlines the way other men studied scripture. The trial records from the Old Bailey, still preserved and now digitised for anyone curious enough to search, describe Cook as having a delicate constitution. He was frequently unwell. Stomach troubles plagued him, persistent weakness that the physicians of his era couldn't quite explain. This chronic sickness shaped Cook's life in ways he couldn't have anticipated. It made him dependent on doctors, made him trust them implicitly, made him grateful for medical attention wherever he could find it. It would prove a fatal dependency.
Among Cook's racing companions was a man who shared his passion for the track, a fellow gambler who happened to be a physician, a man who could tend to Cook's chronic ailments between races, who could prescribe remedies and offer medical advice. His name was William Palmer. What made Palmer dangerous was his respectability. He was born in 1824 in the Staffordshire market town of Rugeley, a place of perhaps 6,000 souls, with a market square, a parish church, and the kind of tight-knit community where everyone knows everyone's business. Palmer's father died when William was 12, leaving a comfortable fortune. The same pattern as Cook, money handed down rather than earned. But where Cook drifted toward pleasure, Palmer pursued profession. He trained at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, one of the great teaching hospitals of the era. Barts, as students called it, have produced surgeons since the 12th century. Its anatomy theaters were legendary. Its faculty included some of the finest medical minds in England. Palmer learned his trade there. He learned to set bones and dress wounds. He learned to recognize symptoms and prescribe treatments. He also learned about poisons. Every medical student of that era studied toxicology. They needed to recognize poisoning symptoms in their patients. They needed to understand antidotes. The curriculum covered arsenic, antimony, prussic acid, the entire pharmacopoeia of death. Palmer qualified as a surgeon in 1846 and returned to Rugeley to establish his practice. On the surface, everything looked respectable. A country surgeon, a pillar of the community. In 1847, he married Anne Thornton, the illegitimate daughter of an Indian army colonel, a woman who brought money to the marriage and respectability to his household. Palmer's reputation seemed secure, but beneath the professional surface, something was consuming William Palmer. Something the neighbors couldn't see. Something that would turn a country doctor into one of the most notorious killers in English history. The races.
What began as occasional wagers became obsession. Palmer bet heavily and lost more heavily. The mathematics of gambling addiction are merciless. Each loss demands another bet to recover, and each recovery attempt fails more catastrophically than the last. By the early 1850s, Palmer owed money to multiple lenders. The debts mounted faster than his medical practice could ever hope to recover. A country surgeon's income, perhaps £200 or £300 annually, couldn't touch obligations that had grown into the thousands. Palmer grew desperate. He forged his mother's signature on documents to secure loans. He borrowed against property he didn't own. He made promises he couldn't keep to men who would eventually demand payment. Each scheme bought time, but time was running out. And then people around Palmer started dying. Palmer's mother-in-law, Mary Thornton, visited Rugeley in January 1849. She stayed in Palmer's home as an honoured guest. Within 2 weeks, she fell violently ill. The symptoms were sudden, the death was quick. Palmer inherited money from her estate. No one investigated. His wife, Anne Palmer, fell ill in September 1854. Sudden symptoms, convulsions, rapid deterioration. The death certificate said cholera. A cholera pandemic was sweeping Britain that year, killing 23,000 people across the country. No one questioned another death among so many. But Palmer had recently taken out life insurance on Anne, worth £13,000. The premium alone had cost £760, an enormous sum that raised eyebrows even at the insurance company. The policy was so large that three separate insurers had agreed to split the risk among them. Anne died on September the 29th, 1854. She was 27 years old. She left behind a husband who had insured her life for a fortune. The insurance paid. At least four of Palmer's infant children died in convulsions during their first year of life. Victorian infant mortality was tragically common. One in four children died before the age of five. Convulsions could result from fever, from infection, from 100 causes that medicine couldn't yet explain. No one suspected anything when a baby stopped breathing in the night. The neighbours couldn't know what was happening behind the Palmer family's closed doors. The pattern only became visible in hindsight. A mother-in-law, a wife, four children. Each death brought Palmer either money or relief from expense. Each death came suddenly. Each death went unquestioned. And then there was his brother.
Walter Palmer was William's younger brother and a known alcoholic. His drinking had alienated much of the family. He had no savings, no prospects, nothing of apparent value. But in January 1855, William Palmer took a sudden interest in Walter's welfare. What happened next reveals how methodically Palmer planned his crimes. He arranged life insurance policies totaling £13,000 on Walter's life through the Solicitors and General Life Assurance Society. £13,000 on a man with no assets, no income, no apparent reason to be insured for such a staggering sum. The insurance company required a medical examination before approving the policy. William Palmer examined his own brother. He signed the forms attesting that Walter was a sound risk. He falsified everything. The policy was approved. In August 1855, Walter visited Rugeley. He stayed with his brother William. He drank, as he always drank. And within days, he suddenly fell ill. The symptoms were familiar by now. Violent stomach pains, convulsions, rapid deterioration. The same pattern that had claimed so many others in William Palmer's orbit. Walter died on August 16, 1855. Palmer filed the insurance claim immediately. But this time, the insurance companies investigated. They sent private detectives to Rugeley. They discovered that Palmer had tried to insure other people in his life. A farmer who worked for him. Various acquaintances. Anyone whose death might bring him money. The companies refused to pay Walter's claim. They recommended a formal inquiry into the circumstances of his death. Palmer was running out of options, running out of schemes, running out of people to kill for profit. And then his friend John Parsons Cook won £3,000 at the races. By November 1855, William Palmer's situation had become desperate. He owed more than £20,000 to moneylenders, a debt that would take a country surgeon two lifetimes to repay through honest work. The interest compounded monthly. The forged documents could be discovered at any moment. The insurance investigators were asking questions about Walter's death that Palmer couldn't answer without incriminating himself. If the fraud was exposed, if the insurance companies prosecuted, Palmer would lose everything. His practice, his reputation, his freedom, perhaps his life. He needed money immediately. And at the Shrewsbury races, his friend John Parsons Cook was about to win a considerable sum. The Shrewsbury Handicap Stakes, November 13th through 15th, 1855. John Parsons Cook had entered his horse Polster in the races. Palmer traveled with him, as he often did, bringing his own horse, a runner called Nettle, and his own hopes for profit. The races drew crowds from across the region. Bookmakers worked the stands, calling odds that shifted with every rumor. Money changed hands in quantities that would take a working man years to earn. The atmosphere crackled with possibility. Palmer bet heavily on Nettle. Palmer lost. Cook bet on Polster. Polster won. John Parsons Cook collected somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 pounds in winnings. Cook stood in the paddock, counting banknotes. His face flushed with victory, while Palmer watched from the rail. That evening, the two men celebrated at the Raven Hotel in Shrewsbury. Cook ordered champagne. Palmer provided brandy from a bottle he carried with him. After drinking the brandy Palmer gave him, Cook's throat burned. He became violently ill, vomiting, weakness, searing pain that seemed to come from nowhere. Cook confided to friends at the hotel. He said it plainly, without hesitation in front of witnesses. I believe that Dan Palmer has been dosing me. And yet, when it came time to leave Shrewsbury, Cook accepted Palmer's offer to escort him home to Rugeley. Why? Because Palmer was a doctor, and doctors could be trusted. Because Cook was already sick, and Palmer promised to attend him personally. Because suspicion isn't certainty, and Cook couldn't prove anything. Because in 1855, a physician's word carried the weight of law. Cook climbed into the carriage beside the man he believed was poisoning him. They traveled together through the November countryside. They arrived in Rugeley as the gas lamps were being lit.
Rugeley in 1855 was a market town in Staffordshire, nestled in the English Midlands. Population around 6,000. Gas lamps lit the main streets after dark, their yellow glow fighting against the November fog. The railway had arrived 8 years earlier, connecting the town to Birmingham and London, transforming it from an isolated backwater to an accessible destination. The Talbot Arms stood on Market Street, the main thoroughfare through town, a respectable coaching inn, the kind of establishment where travelling gentlemen took rooms, where commercial travellers conducted business, and when racing men gathered to discuss form and settle wagers. Cook settled there whenever he visited Rugeley. His usual accommodation was Room 10. Room 10 faced the street, and directly across that narrow street, perhaps 20 yards of cobblestones, stood William Palmer's house. The geography matters. From his surgery window, Palmer could watch Cook's bedroom. He could see when the light went out. He could see when visitors arrived. He could track the movements of servants carrying trays. He could time his own visits to the minute. John Parsons Cook arrived in Rugeley on November the 15th. He took Room 10, as he always did. Before leaving Shrewsbury, Cook had taken one precaution. He deposited most of his winnings, nearly £3,000, with a racing acquaintance named Ishmael Fisher, a man he trusted, a place Palmer couldn't reach. But Cook couldn't protect himself from what Palmer had already done. Whatever poison had been in that brandy was already working. The game was already lost. Palmer visited immediately. He would tend to his friend's illness, he said. He would prescribe medications. He would bring food and drink prepared with his own hands. The chambermaid, Elizabeth Mills, noticed how frequently the doctor crossed the street, how he insisted on administering every treatment himself, how he never let anyone else prepare Cook's meals or deliver his medicine. A physician attending a sick friend, what could be more natural? What could be more kind?
In 1855, there was no reliable test for strychnine. The poison killed through convulsions and paralysis, but it metabolized rapidly in the body, leaving little trace for chemists to find. Palmer knew this. He was counting on it. A physician who wanted to murder could choose his poison carefully. He could calculate doses with precision. He could time symptoms to avoid suspicion. He could stand beside the deathbed, taking a pulse with steady hands, while his patient screamed. John Parsons Cook had 5 days left to live. Over those 5 days, Palmer would cross the street rapidly. He would intercept medications prescribed by other doctors. He would bring pills prepared in his own surgery. He would hover at Cook's bedside like the most devoted friend imaginable. And each time Cook recovered slightly, another dose would send him back into agony. Here's what haunts me about this case. Cook knew. He told his friends at the Raven Hotel that Palmer was poisoning him. He said it out loud in front of witnesses. And he still got in that carriage. Still took that room across from Palmer's house. Still let the doctor bring him medicine every day. Would you have done the same? When the person poisoning you is the only physician willing to treat you? When trust and danger wear the same face, what choice do you really have? Next time on Foul Play, the sick room, the strychnine, and the final scream. Cook will cry out murder as his body seizes. He will name his killer with his dying breath. And William Palmer, calm, professional, taking notes, will watch him die. Until next time, good night, friend.
This episode sponsored by Vita Hustle.
Why aren't you eating right? Because eating right is hard? Because it isn't! Kevin Hart fixed it 4 damn years ago with The One. The One is Vita Hustle's game-changing, meal-replacing super shake, inspired by Kevin Hart's passionate belief that we all have the right to eat right. Kevin Hart is referring to himself in the third person because he's fired up, because The One just passed 5 million super shakes sold. 5 million. Just a quick gut-healthy glass of The One gives you all the proteins, all the greens, and all the vitamins and more. One shake, no chaos. Listeners get 20% off their first purchase at VitaHustle.com. Go to VitaHustle.com. That's VitaHustle.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Go to Dutch.com to get vet care that is always there for just $92 a year.